Welcome to Division 7 of the Colorado Court of Appeals. To my left is Judge Miller. To my right is Judge Jones. And I'm Judge Roman. We have two cases on the docket today, People v. Love, 06CA1632. Are counsel here? Ready to go? Very good. And the second case, People v. Pebbler, 07CA0364. And are counsel here for that case? I'm ready to go.
Yes.
Very good. Then you've been given instructions on the court's policies and procedures and rules. I take it there are no questions, but if there are, this is your chance to ask. Seeing none, then I would just remind everybody who's here today in attendance that if you have a cell phone or a pager or something else that might emit noise, please have it turned off at this point. And with that, we're ready for the first argument.
May it please the court, Shan Jeffrey on behalf of Derek Love, the defendant appellant. Your Honors, this is the case in which Mr. Love was summoned for the first time to appear for his retrial a mere 7 days before the trial date. The trial date was a mere 3 days before the 6-month speedy trial period expired for retrial. He had no counsel, but he did have one thing. He had a strong resolution not to waive his right to speedy trial.
Ms. Jeffrey.
Yes.
I want to get right to the heart of this as I see it.
Okay.
That is your statement that he had no counsel. Now, I recognize that at the hearing, the public defenders who were present said they had not been appointed, but I'm curious about the process.
Okay.
The public defender's office had represented the defendant during his second trial and on appeal. I couldn't find anything in the record that indicated how it came to be that they were appointed to represent him in the second trial, but nevertheless, they did. I am curious as to why it was necessary to have another appointment after the remand. And I guess to put it another way, why wasn't the appointment for the second trial still good? Why didn't the public defender's office still represent the defendant? And I'll tell you why I ask this question. The statute indicates that when the public defender's office is appointed for indigent defendant, they are appointed for all proceedings. Now, I think all means all. Why doesn't all mean a new trial on remand?
Your Honor, at the point that Mr. Love made his first appearance after the mandate had issued, which had reversed his conviction and sentence after the second trial, he no longer had counsel because there was no trial pending. There was no trial date pending. The mandate had issued. That case was over. Now, whether or not the prosecutor sought to retry Mr. Love was within his discretion. And he almost didn't, because he almost let the speedy trial period expire after retrial. You get the public defender appointed again after you make a first appearance after retrial. And also the public defender just go ahead.
You say that's what happens, and I'm wondering, what's the legal basis for that? Is that just how it's done? What's the statutory basis for that?
Well, I could have come prepared for that had I known I would face that question, but I don't have that statute memorized, Your Honor. But the fact remains that the mandate had issued. That case was gone. The second trial was gone. That case was gone. There were no pending charges at that point against Mr. Love. So he needs a new appointment, and he needs new counsel because, Your Honor, although the public defender's office was appointed for the second trial, they were different attorneys. Those attorneys that tried Mr. Love's second trial were gone from the office at the point that Charles Garcia didn't make an appearance on his behalf, but showed up at court on that date of first appearance. So those new public defenders were completely unfamiliar with this case and not yet appointed.
Well, I understand, but when the public defender's office is appointed, the court doesn't say, and I want these two people to be the lawyers. That's the public defender's office who does that. So the fact that the public defenders who represented the defendant the first go around left, I mean, the judge doesn't step in then and say, because he doesn't know what's happening. He doesn't know these people have left. Okay, why isn't it the public defender's responsibility to say, oh, these two people left, we need replacements.
Because there was no trial date set for any retrial until this happened.
The charges were still pending. The charges did not have to be refiled, and they weren't refiled. The charges are still pending. He's still sitting in jail for 5 months.
In prison, yes.
Yeah, on charges. He's charged.
No. He's not sitting in prison on charges, Your Honor. What? They could have released him as soon as the mandate issued, and in fact, they probably should have.
Well, whose responsibility was that to bring that to the attention of the court?
The prosecutors, Your Honor. The prosecutors. And that is clear by statute.
He had a lawyer.
No, he did not. No, he did not.
All right.
Once the mandate issues, my job as his appellate attorney was done.
Right. As an appellate
attorney. I no longer represented Mr. Love after that point. And he also didn't have trial counsel appointed yet. If you would like me to brief that, I would be happy to. I really don't want to spend my whole time in oral argument arguing that one point. But I would be happy to file a supplemental brief on that if you would like.
Well, I know you want to spend your time on other things, but I have some questions about this.
Okay.
Because there are some fundamental premises here that I have a problem with. And that is your statement that as appellate attorney, your job was over. Yes, it was. Okay. But there is a remand for a new trial. That's what the remand order says.
Right.
There are charges pending. I can't find any authority that says the appointment of the public defender to represent him in, quote, all proceedings, end quote, as the statute says, and it says even after conviction, doesn't include a retrial.
Your Honor, he no longer had trial counsel from the second trial. That counsel's job was over when the notice of appeal was filed.
But
the trial court loses jurisdiction over the case.
And then
he doesn't have a public defender when there's no jurisdiction in the trial court over his case. He doesn't have a trial court public defender.
Right.
Loses jurisdiction.
Right.
Okay. Trial court loses jurisdiction. Trial court public defender no longer on case. Then it goes to the Court of Appeals, and Mr. Love gets an appellate public defender. That was me. My job for him ended when the mandate issued, returning jurisdiction to the trial court. And at that point, he needed to be appointed counsel again, or not if he chose to waive his right to counsel, which is exactly what happened in this case.
But where is there a waiver of the right to counsel on the record?
Well, let's go over that. I have given you a demonstrative exhibit that you should have there at your chair. It comes straight from the record from the initial speedy trial period.
I take it that you have a copy and you're fine.
Yes, I did give him a copy.
Okay, go ahead.
Because I think the record is a little confusing during that first hearing because there was so much processing going on by the court and by both counsel as to how they could possibly go forward with the speedy trial date in just 7 days on a second-degree murder trial, I thought I would just go ahead and highlight the very statements of Mr. Love in contrast to everything else that was said about his rights. So in bold, you have Mr. Love's statements, his only statements, except for a few paragraphs where he's talking about where he doesn't feel he's in a fair predicament here. But these are his assertion of rights for you in bold. So first we have the fact that he moves for violation of speedy trial right off the bat. The district court says no because your trial date hasn't occurred yet, so that motion's premature. And he gives him three choices. He says, one, you can waive your speedy trial and I'll appoint you the public defender. Your Honor, the judge found, as a matter of historical fact, that he had not yet been appointed the public defender, and that's a finding that's due deference.
Well, I don't see a finding here, but go on.
Well, he's saying he can appoint the public defender, which implies he's not yet appointed the public defender. That's the finding.
I guess my problem with this is that there are parties making a lot of assumptions here that I'm not sure are backed up by any legal authority. The judge may be making an assumption here because the PD show up and say, we're here, but we're not representing him. And the judge may think, oh, okay, fine. We'll get around to that, the appointment issue. The judge may be mistaken, is what I'm getting at.
Well, but it's a finding of historical fact on the record, and there's nothing in the record to refute that, and we cannot make findings for the first time on appeal.
Well, it's not a finding of fact. It's a legal question as to whether the public defender's office from the first trial or the second trial continued to represent him. That's a legal question.
Well, like I said, I could perhaps brief that for you if you'd like to give me the opportunity. Maybe I could look at the minute orders, and that would answer the question or something like that.
Let me ask you another question. Let's say that the judge had allowed the defendant to represent himself and go to trial within the speedy trial period, so we wouldn't have a speedy trial issue. wouldn't you be standing in front of us saying he was denied his right to counsel? Because I don't see an Arguello advisement here. You'd be saying this is not an effective waiver of right to counsel, wouldn't you?
No, I wouldn't, because that wasn't the basis under the Arguello case. That was not the basis that the trial court denied him his right to represent himself. He didn't even enter into the Arguello advisement because he, from a patriarchal standpoint, he was saying, I believe it's in your best interest to have the public defender's office and for you to waive speedy, so I'm going to override your decision to represent yourself. And when a defendant decides to represent himself, when he asserts that constitutional right, he has no redress under ineffective assistance of counsel. That goes away.
So just to be clear, are you saying there was no waiver of the right to counsel?
There was a waiver to the right to counsel, absolutely.
It was a knowing, intelligent waiver, fully informed?
Yes, and the record would support that. He'd been through this trial twice before. He knew what he was up against. The judge never made a finding that he was incapable of representing himself, never made a finding that this was not a knowing, voluntary, and intelligent waiver of counsel. He chose himself as counsel, and it was his constitutional right under Feretta to do so.
Well, it seems to me from the record, the court thought that he had not waived his right to counsel. In fact, the court says so. The court says after he makes this statement, good, because I'm not going to waive my right to speedy, the court goes on and says that he hasn't waived his right to counsel.
No, he never did, Your Honor. I disagree with that fully. This is what the court said. At the very end, we can skip to the end since I'm obviously not going to have time to go through this all with you. Well, I guess you get to go to trial by yourself then, Mr. Love. Good, because I'm not going to waive my speedy.
That wasn't the end of the hearing. Keep going.
That was his final statement. That's Mr. Love's final statement.
But the court after that says the defendant hasn't waived his right to counsel and defendant does not speak.
Where does he say that?
Excuse me, counsel, I'm here to ask the questions.
I'm sorry. I don't believe that's how it occurred, Your Honor. I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I've read this over and over, and I don't remember him ever saying that you have waived your right to go pro se. I don't remember him ever saying that. And in fact, the court makes this finding. There's certainly been no express waiver of speedy trial on the part of the defendant. In fact, I think everyone acknowledged that the defendant is as strongly as possible telling me he wants to go to trial within the current speedy trial period. And the only way he could do that was to waive his right to an effective public defender because the public defender had represented on the record that he could not be effective within 1 week. But guess what? Mr. Love could, and even if he couldn't be effective, it didn't matter because he still had the right to sit on his laurels and see if the prosecutor could really muster up 24 prosecution witnesses in 7 days' time and all the other things that he would have had to do to be ready for this trial. Mr. Love had every right to call the prosecution's bluff in this case. That was a sound defense strategy. He was acting as its own counsel when he made that decision, and the judge completely overrode it, which was constitutional error under Feretta. And this continuance was not chargeable to Mr. Love, and so the remedy is reversal of his conviction and sentence and remand for dismissal of the charges, because the continuance should have been the prosecution's continuance all along.
So the defendant has a right to play a gambit, even if the gambit would backfire on him and he would end up going to trial and getting slaughtered. You say that's his right to make that
decision. Well, that's not inevitable, Your Honor. He had been through this trial twice before. He was fully capable, there are no findings to suggest otherwise, of making the prosecution meet its burden in 7 days. And if it's all right, I'd like to see the rest of my time.
Well, Ms. Jeffrey, I have a follow-up question.
Let's go ahead and stop the clock for right now, though. Go ahead.
Ms. Jeffrey, I have a follow-up question.
Okay.
Let's say hypothetically, I think we can agree that there wasn't an express waiver of speedy trial here. That's clear, and the court so found, that's clear from the record. So that the defendant intended to stand on his right to speedy trial. Hypothetically, I'm not asking you to concede this because I know you won't. Hypothetically, what if he also did not waive his right to counsel? In that situation where he doesn't waive his right to speedy and he doesn't waive his right to counsel, how is a court, like the trial court here, supposed to resolve that sort of conflict?
How can he not waive his right to counsel when he asserts his right to self-representation? That is his right to counsel. He's choosing himself. He's choosing his own counsel because he knows that by choosing his own counsel and by going to trial in 7 days, that's the only way he's going to be able to call what he sees as the prosecutor's bluff in this case. He had every right to pursue that as his defense strategy in this case. And the court simply overrode it, and it wasn't allowable under Feretta.
Because I gave Ms. Jeffrey a couple extra minutes, you can have them as well if you need them at the
end. Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, John First for the people. Good afternoon. I do have some prepared remarks, but I think given the direction the argument has taken, I think I'll start by asking the court where it would like to begin.
Well, let's begin where the prior discussion left off. You heard my colleague, Judge Jones, asking about what burdens, if any, the defendant has or the public defender has in this situation. What's your response to that?
In terms of burdens, I guess where we immediately ended off was this hypothetical when the statutory right of speedy collides essentially with the constitutional right to effective counsel. I mean, we have to, Gallagher says we defer to counsel when we have to. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said when statutory and constitutional rights conflict, we have to go with the constitutional right. The issue arises with conflicts of interest where we have competing constitutional rights. That's not what's at issue here.
But he has a constitutional right to represent himself, doesn't he?
He does if he unequivocally requests it. And that's our position, is there certainly no unequivocal request. The only time where we even touch upon self-representation is in this heated back and forth. I mean, in the trial court, I think it's clear even from a cold record, the trial court's becoming increasingly frustrated with this whole situation. There's no question this case fell through the cracks. We're not disputing that.
Well, counsel, what's equivocal about saying good because I'm not going to waive my speedy?
Because the court said, well, the context is that the court had in its mind at that point only essentially, well, the court called it three choices at this point. Within speedy. One, he could accept counsel, and I don't have an answer to your question, Judge, about why they believed that counsel hadn't been appointed. Everybody seemed to assume that, but that's the way it is now.
Well, I need to ask you the same question that I asked Ms. Jeff, which is, why is that? I mean, what is it about the process, and what is the legal basis for the process where You have a lawyer, and if your conviction gets reversed, you don't have a lawyer. Your lawyer doesn't continue to represent you. You must get a reappointment. What's your understanding of that?
I don't. That troubled me. I mean, I have no. I mean, the statute seems to. You seem to be reading the statute correctly. I think practically the mechanism is when it comes back on remand, the trial court sets a hearing.
Right.
I mean, that's.
Which didn't happen here.
It did not happen.
Not for
5 months. And only 5 months in a week, actually. The record, and briefly, just for accuracy, it looks like the setting occurred on July 5th. That's when there's a minute order where the defendant was writted, right. Where an order from the court to the clerk to writ the defendant. And on the 6th, he was actually writted. The hearing occurred on the 11th. Speedy would have run on the 26th, July 26th, because the mandate was received on January 26th, just for accuracy of dates. But
I've heard it's the 21st or the 25th.
The court was wrong. Well, it's clear from the minute orders and the register of actions that the mandate was received. And a subsequent hearing, Judge Martinez noted that it was the 26th. And the mandate, the record bears that out. Well, we're, you know, for effectiveness of counsel, 5 days, we're not going to say makes a difference. No counsel could have been ready in 10 days or 7 days or 12 days.
This is relevant, though, because
I believe, yeah.
Because ordinarily, as you say, upon a remand, the court's going to get the order. It's going to say, okay, we need to reset this thing. Okay?
Correct.
And presumably, in the ordinary course of things, a hearing will be set in relatively short order. The defendant will be called in. His counsel will be called in. If he has counsel, they'll have a hearing. They'll set the whole thing, and no problems. Okay. That didn't happen here. Okay. The court also let things fall through the cracks here.
Absolutely.
That can't be charged to the defendant.
We're not arguing.
The prosecution's failure to bring this to the attention of the court can't be charged to the defendant.
We're not arguing that either.
All right. So what is chargeable to the defendant here? I mean, we go beyond speedy trial here, unquestionably. So why is that chargeable to the defendant and not to the actions of the court and the prosecution?
I think this is a classic Gallagher situation. I mean, from the defendant's perspective, what happened here really is no different than, as in Gallagher, counsel, the public defender, discovers that they have an ethical conflict and they have to get off the case. So at that point, there has to be substitution of counsel. From the defendant's perspective, there is no difference. I mean, we're not saying that defendant did anything. Defendant didn't had no did nothing to cause the delay in Gallagher. Defendant did nothing to cause the delay here. But bottom line is a delay did occur, and everyone, once that was discovered, everyone did everything they could to accommodate the defendant's statutory right to speedy trial and his paramount constitutional right.
But Mr. First, looking at the whole record here of this hearing that happened on July 11th, isn't it quite possible to read that what the defendant is saying is, yes, I want a lawyer, but I only want a lawyer if I can go to trial within the speedy trial deadline. If I can't go to trial within the speedy trial deadline, I don't want a lawyer, because for me, speedy trial is paramount.
That's defendant's argument.
Isn't that a reasonable reading of the record?
It goes back to my earlier question, which I didn't still have
the equivocal. Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah. What is it that's equivocal about saying good because I'm not going to waive my speedy?
Well, because you didn't ask. I mean, it wasn't in the context of asking the court to tell the court I want speedy trial. Well, I mean, I want to represent myself.
It was pretty clear from the court. It says, well, I guess you get to go to trial by yourself then, Mr. Love. Answer, good, because I'm not going to waive my speedy.
Well, first,
it wasn't any clear that he was going to go represent himself at the trial. That's what he was saying, and he didn't want to waive his speedy.
I think it's true with this demonstrative exhibit. I think it takes it out of context. And again, this is what I was getting to before, Your Honor. The context is that the court gave him three choices. One, you can have counsel, and you can waive your statutory speedy, or we can go to trial in a week. Well, that's a non-option. No lawyer's going to go. But anyway,
the prosecutor couldn't have gone in a week either, could he?
Nor could the defendant have gone in a week, and he even says that. And I'll point the court to, at least it's suggested by the record, on the same hearing we're talking about, 7-11 hearing, and I've got it on, I don't have my page numbers here. Let me see if it's before or after the recess. I believe it's before the recess on 7-11, so the morning session of 7-11. Defendant says, I could have been getting prepared. That means he wasn't getting prepared. And again,
but isn't it the fault of the prosecution and the court that nobody was prepared? Nobody does anything about this case until 3 weeks before the expiration of speedy trial.
Well,
isn't that the fault of the prosecution and the court?
What?
And only the prosecution and the court, based on case law, right?
Well, that's true, but again, even in Gallagher, we're not talking about fault of the defendant, but nonetheless, the Supreme Court has said that where the statutory speedy and constitutional effectiveness of counsel collide, we have to defer to the right to counsel. And that's what Gallagher is all about.
But he said in Gallagher, the defendant didn't ask to represent himself. Here is it, at least it's my reading, and I'll go back and read the record in light of your comments, but that the defendant was absolutely clear he was going to try the case himself, if that's what it took in order to get a speedy trial right. So I'm not sure the right to counsel is at issue.
Well, I mean, we have a different, we take a different position on whether or not he unequivocally invoked his right to counsel.
Pardon, Mr. First, let me see if I understand then.
I mean, to defend himself, yeah.
Well, yeah, right.
I understand.
Thank you. But, I mean, if he did, this is a different situation, no question.
All right, so your position hinges upon whether he clearly invoked his right to self-representation.
Well, I think it has to.
If he did, let's assume he did, for purposes of the hypothetical, is it your position you would lose then?
No, I'm not prepared to. I don't know I'm prepared to concede that.
Well, I know that you argue that he didn't clearly do that. I understand your argument. I just want to understand the scope of your argument and the extent of your arguments so we know exactly what to address. If he did, do you lose?
I don't think so. Well,
why not?
I'll say what didn't happen. If he did, I can't say that it was a knowing and voluntary waiver because he never got the full Arguello advice. Now Arguello, granted, is a different situation, but it still speaks to the general principle that a defendant's waiver has to be intelligent. And again, I go back to the context and the heatedness of this and the frustration. The defendant's frustrated because he's been sitting in prison for 167 days by his own admission. I think we'd all be frustrated. The court's frustrated because it slipped through the cracks. The court, along with, is a co-obligor, I guess, to see that this gets done. So the court says, well, I guess, I mean, granted, it's a cold record, but this occurred after, after the court gave him the choices. Public defender said, well, after the recess, we can't represent him in a week. Then the court says, well, I guess you'll have to go on your own based on its own, on the court's own choices. And said, good, well, I'm not waiving my speedy. That was the extent of it. As the court pointed out earlier, the discussion, the hearing went on. And when the court said, well, the context when the court said, well, I guess you get to go on your own, defendant said, good. Court hadn't come to the Gallagher solution yet. And after defendant said, good, that the prosecution said, well, judge, there's another choice. And the judge said, I'm getting to that. Public defender agreed that Gallagher allowed it, but wasn't conceding it, but agreed that Gallagher also would allow a solution to the situation. At the point when, and I, to answer your question, Your Honor, I'd say no, because we would not lose, because at the point where, well, I reluctantly appoint the public defender, find an implied waiver of speedy, it was at that point that the defendant, if he unequivocally wanted to proceed pro se, should have said, whoa, I want to represent myself. What is this public defender? Said nothing. Had never after that, the defendant again asked to go pro se. The motions to dismiss, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, if speedy trial had expired, anything that happens after that is irrelevant. And so the fact that he's including his conviction, if speedy trial had expired, the fact that he was even convicted becomes a nullity. Similarly, any alleged waiver that occurs after the speedy trial expires is a nullity.
No, nobody's. Well, if it had truly expired, but the court had found that it hadn't, had found an implied waiver, so.
That's what we're here for, right? To decide if it expired.
Well, but even then, but the court at that point said it hadn't expired and found an implied waiver, so that the case wasn't subject to dismissal. So I'm not sure about it. I don't think so.
But I don't think you can criticize the defendant for, once his rights that he asserted had been denied, for saying, okay, well, I guess I'll take a, if I'm going to go to trial outside of speedy trial, sure, I'd like to have a lawyer.
Well, it's not so much a criticism as a reflection of his state of mind and whether he really wanted to proceed pro se. I mean, we're talking about whether the waiver is unequivocal. Case law is clear. It has to be unequivocal. And I don't think this is it.
What could he have said that would have been more unequivocal?
He could have said, when the court said, "We're, you know, I'm filing an implied waiver, you're going to have counsel. No, I don't want counsel. I still want to go to trial on my own."
Before speedy, you mean he has to say, he has to waive counsel for all time, for all purposes?
No, but he had to do it. He can't just do it saying, good, because I want my right to speedy, when the judge says, well, I guess you have to. I don't think the context bears out an unequivocal waiver. Anyway, I
know you're out of time, but I have another question about the same thing. What, in your view, has to happen before there can be this unequivocal invocation of the right to self-representation? Does there also have to be, in addition to saying, I want to represent myself, does there also have to be this advisement by the court of the right to counsel and what he's giving up by deciding to represent himself?
Well, we know that the reason it has to be unequivocal is because the defendant has a fundamental right to counsel, and the waiver of the right to counsel has to be knowing, express, and voluntary. And that's what the case is. That's the rationale for why the invocation of the right to self-representation has to be unequivocal.
I guess my
point is, and so it's wrapped up in that, so that.
But is it the end of it? I guess if, assuming hypothetically, a defendant unequivocally says, I want to represent myself, can the court just simply accept that?
No.
Without going further? What does the court need to do?
Well, Ferretta Romero says there has to, you have to, I mean, Arguello gets it's understand the disadvantages and dangers of proceeding pro se. I mean, that comes out of Ferretta. And so the defendant has to be affirmatively advised of the dangers and disadvantages of proceeding pro se.
But there again, would that be a burden of compliance on the trial court as opposed to the defendant? I mean, he's probably not going to know about his Arguello advisement rights and that he ought to be given those now.
Well, it's not so much a burden, but it still has to be intelligent waiver.
So his right to represent himself can be denied simply by the trial court deciding not to give the Arguello advisement?
I don't know that it could be denied.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
And Ms. Jeffrey, you have 2 minutes and 6 seconds.
Go as quickly as I can. This case is not Gallagher, because in Gallagher, the defendant never waived his right to counsel by asserting his right to represent himself.
Ms. Jeffrey,
yes.
I want to ask the same question,
okay,
just to ask Mr. First, so I can understand this clearly. Let's assume that your client unequivocally said, I want to represent myself. Okay. In your view, was the court obligated to make any further inquiry before there could be a waiver of right to counsel found, or is that it?
Only if the court suspected that he was incapable of mounting his own defense. And the court in this case made no findings. There was no record that there was even a suspicion that he was incapable. And in fact, finding him capable of mounting his own defense under the circumstances is supported by the history of this case, because he'd been through this trial twice in the past. He was the only defense person in the room that could have gone to trial on little notice. The public defender below never conceded that this was a Gallagher solution when the judge overrode Mr. Love's complimentary rights to speedy trial and his right to represent himself. I addressed this in my brief, in my reply brief, so if you have a question about that, please look at that. And Judge Jones, after a little more reflection on your first question to me, I have a little more of an answer for you. Mr. Love needed a new appointment upon retrial because he had a constitutional right to choice of counsel at that point. So just because he had the public defender before didn't mean that he would choose to have the public defender again. He could choose to go pro se, or if he had funds to hire private counsel the second time, he could choose that route. So the statute says there has to be an order of appointment, and the reason it's not simply retained from a previous case is because he has a constitutional right to choice of counsel.
All right, I want to follow up on that because now we still are in the same case number, the same charges. So we're in the same case. So I don't think that's an issue. So I want to explore this idea of constitutional right to counsel. That, of course, exists throughout the entire course of the proceedings. So in other words, at motion stage, a defendant could say to himself, I'm not happy with this lawyer. I want a different lawyer, and has a constitutional right to maybe have a substitution of counsel. I guess what I'm saying is, if we accept your explanation there, then does the court have to re-advise the defendant, reappoint the public defender's office for every hearing? Because theoretically, the defendant can get rid of the public defender at any point in the proceeding.
Well, I think when an appointment is made initially at the first appearance, that appointment extends through the entire trial proceedings, or at least it's assumed it will. Now, if at a later time a defendant becomes dissatisfied with the public defender, that defendant can move for substitute counsel if he thinks there's a conflict of interest. He can make a record on getting alternate defense counsel. If he decides he wants to go pro se and it's not too late, it's not too far into the trial proceedings, such that that would be a manipulation of the court process, then the judge can let him go pro se at that point if he makes the right findings, or if it would serve the defendant's asserted constitutional rights to do so. Sometimes we're appointed and then family members come up with money to hire private counsel. So that's another option if it wouldn't thwart the judicial economy, you know, if it wouldn't be a manipulation of the court process. So there are all kinds of scenarios that can happen once a public defender's been appointed for a particular trial. But here, that had not yet happened. At least everyone was under the impression that it had not yet happened. And in the record, I certainly never saw, prior to this first appearance, any new appointment of the public defender's office by statute, nor should there have been, because Mr. Love didn't have a chance to talk about whether he wanted the public defender for this trial or not.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.